Welcome to the politicalbetting.com polling matter show. My name is Kieran Pedley. We were off last week, so certainly a lot to catch up on. The Prime Minister's interest seems to be growing ever more. There's Brexit, of course, but now the thorny issue of a by-election in Richmond following the government's decision to carry on with their plans to expand Heathrow Airport. We'll be discussing that by-election, what to expect, and also the wider political implications of the vote. Later in the show, Leo's going to be taking us through some analysis of Labour's so-called floor. There's a big debate amongst academics and pollsters around how low the Labour vote realistically can go. We'll be looking at some of the numbers and discussing what we think. We'll also make time to talk about UKIP's upcoming leadership election campaign. Now, many people think post-Brexit, UKIP's finished. But is that true? We'll be talking about that later. And also making time to talk about a politicalbetting.com poll, which looks at how a stop Brexit party might do in a general election. So lots to discuss on this show. I'm joined by regular contributors, Asa Bennett of The Telegraph and Leo Barassi of Noise of the Crowd. Welcome, gents.
Thank you.
Asa, I'll start with you. So as I sort of mentioned in the introduction, there's certainly a lot going on for the Prime Minister at the moment, a very busy intray, and things seem to be mounting up, don't they?
Well, absolutely. She's got a very, very stacked intray indeed. And obviously, this is dominated by Brexit. It remains still the looming challenge as she has to really get something solid going. First with her government, just to decide what the heck the strategy is. Obviously, we don't know fully because she still won't give a running commentary on this or even a standing or limping commentary. And then she has to go and take this to the EU. Certainly, she's had initial discussions. And obviously, they've said they'll give her nothing or they'll give her something very bad indeed and made very menacing noises. And if at the moment, it's all just a sort of phony war, in a sense, before Article 50 is invoked and they get down to detail, because all she can say to them at the moment is that she wants a unique deal and it will be wonderful, and they can say, no, we won't give you that. And so that's why she has to keep the Tory backbenchers happy, though, in the meantime. But they seem to cautiously be, because, you know, they don't know, they have little to scrutinise. But, of course, in the meantime, the people who will be doing the scrutinising are getting their act together. We've got Hilary Benn, now chair of the Brexit Select Committee, and his new members, including Michael Gove and Dominic Raab and John Whittingdale, and also lots of Labour Remainers on there, who will be ready to sort of hold these ministers' feet to the fire. So there'll be a lot more conversations happening where, you know, Liam Fox and David Davis will be having to explain themselves and be having to ask even more questions of what they can reveal and all the rest. And so, at the same time, she's going to be... It's fascinating what we see here, because she's standing very high. The expectations have to be high because she knows there'll have to be a compromise at the end of the day. She's seen what happened with David Cameron. She knows this is the history of European politics. There's always fudge involved. And it depends where it's going to be, because obviously UKIP, they're having trouble now. They're insisting they'll be backsliding. And it looks like that will be landing somewhere on immigration, because you look at the word control, she likes to say. Well, there'll be control on immigration. It's not curbs. And that's a way of saying that maybe that, you know, immigration won't necessarily be cut, but at least we'll have a choice of, you know, whether to do it or not. Of course, that's not good enough for UKIP, because they'll be trying to reinterpret Brexit as a vote for, you know, massive cuts. This is not something that, of course, the sort of vote leavers like Daniel Hannan would agree with. And in the end, there's going to be a sort of a battle for her of trying to sell this compromise to voters and her party, in a sense, because, you know, the Tory Eurosceptics, they'll be thinking, you know, there must be cuts too. And at the same time, there's other domestic politics in the meantime, like Heathrow, of course. Yes, Richmond Park, Zach Goldsmith kicking up a fuss, and, you know, the by-election there. I would suspect that's not going to be too much of a problem for her, because she's priced in that Zach Goldsmith's going to resign. At least she's taken a decision, and so some of her MPs will be grateful for this. I mean, Boris Johnson, for example, he previously said he'd be lying in front of the bulldozers to stop Heathrow. And he's gone a bit quiet about that. He's just merely said
he has gone quiet about that. I mean, certainly not for me to say that he has rhetoric that he doesn't deliver on. I mean, look at the intray in more detail. One thing that strikes me is this is Scotland, of course. Now, yes, she had the devolved ministers in earlier this week to discuss the implications there, and that seems to be a huge challenge. And Nicola Sturgeon seems to be playing quite a skillful game, doesn't she?
Yes, well, I mean, obviously, she and sort of Karen Jones for Wales and, you know, the similar leaders, they did seem to highlight this idea of, you know, oh, there's a bit too much uncertainty here. There was not enough detail for us. And obviously, I would never accuse Nicola Sturgeon of trying to push something for partisan advantage, in a sense, just to suggest that Westminster is, you know, daring to do Scotland injustice so she can further this independence referendum idea. Mm. But, you know, it certainly seems that there's a wider game she's playing here, in that it's not just, you know, because it's certainly unfavourable to have other leaders publicly saying, oh, I looked in there, I got shown the secret Brexit strategy, and there's nothing there, it's all emperor's new clothes. But then she's playing to a Scottish audience, you know, the at-home base, in a sense, in that they want to have this kind of independence referendum at some point. Even though the EU has told her, no, we won't accept an independent Scotland as a new member, you know, she still has to play the game to try and, you know, stave off Ruth Davidson and the unionists on the, you know, who are on their up, and, you know, all the rest.
it's certainly a difficult balancing act. I mean, Leo, before we go on to Heathrow, which I think will dominate some of our discussion today, I mean, if we look at that sort of busy in-tray that Theresa May has, I mean, what sort of stands out for you? I mean, obviously, we'll come to Heathrow in a moment.
Yeah, well, I think the interesting one for me is Richmond. And in a way, that's because I think it's deceptively unthreatening for the government. I think in a funny way, it's potentially a bit of a win-win. So let's say you're Theresa May and Goldsmith wins. Well, great, your candidate's won. But let's say he loses then, and the Lib Dems win. Well, you know, that means that your renegade who resigned and said that he was opposing your policy lost. So that looks like a vote for Heathrow. So from the government's perspective, it's perhaps not so dangerous. I think the real pressure on it is for the Lib Dems. Now, if they win, then that's really interesting for them. That helps their narrative of the Lib Dem fight back. If they don't win, well, where do they go after that? It's sort of, they've got to be winning seats like this if they're going to be seriously a force again. So it's perhaps actually the pressure on them here.
Well, let's look at some of the numbers there. So Zach Goldsmith has a majority of 23,000 in Richmond, and also is the sort of, at the moment, the favourite with Ladbrokes, although the betting seems to be all over the place. I think there was a stage yesterday where the Liberal Democrats were favourites. I think it's now gone back to Zach Goldsmith. I mean, Asa, what's your impression here? There seems to be differences of opinion that at the impact that not being the official Conservative Party candidate might have on Zach Goldsmith in terms of databases and whether he's able to have voter contact and, you know, with certain people and that sort of thing. I mean, how confident would you be if you're Zach Goldsmith? I mean, probably reasonably confident, otherwise you wouldn't have
made the promise. Accept it's definitely a gamble. It's not a certainty, because the Goldsmith brand's been damaged, let's accept this, after the London mayoral campaign. You know, it showed that the Goldsmith, you know, no pun intended, didn't have the Midas touch politically. You know, he was sort of not really reaching out to the
capital. I hope that pun was intended.
It may have been. I felt I had to get that caveat. But nonetheless, in all this, he showed that, although Richmond, they may love him. He's a local celebrity. He's shown that he can, you know, kick up a storm when he needs to highlight the issue of Heathrow opposition. I mean, you have to look at it this way. He wants it as a referendum on Heathrow. There are no pro-Heathrow candidates he's fighting. So as a result, it's just, you know, do you want to conserve, you know, Zach Goldsmith, who's anti-Heathrow, or a Lib Dem who's anti-Heathrow? You know, it's not a surprise. There won't be much of a debate that way. So this is why other issues like Brexit can creep in, which obviously Sunny Carr mercilessly battered him over the head with during the mayoral campaign, just to sort of show he's out of step with Londoners. So I feel there's a similar thing that will be happening here in Richmond, given that, according to various estimates, it's either 2/3 or 77% of Richmond Park residents who, you know, voted for Remain. So they're going to be looking at him a bit askance then, given how he'll be forced to defend Brexit. And the trouble is, he's not one for sort of passionate, soaring rhetoric in these cases. He's very much a sort of shy church mouse of a sort of politician, in a sense. So it may not be very comfortable for him having to do this.
You've got to assume it's going to be a low turnout referendum as well. I mean, you know, people are not going to be motivated for it.
It's looking to be at some point in December. I think it'll be moved definitely imminently.
It's a cold, wet sort of winter's night.
Yes.
Not ideal for sort of high turnouts, is it?
Yeah, which essentially makes it unpredictable, right? Mm. You know, we just don't know who is going to come out and vote, whether it's going to be this possibly existent or non-existent personal support for Zach, or, you know, whether it's just going to be a bunch of other people.
I suppose there's another dynamic here, which is, despite the Prime Minister's constant reassurance there will be no early election before 2020, these sorts of by-elections do raise the spectre of that, how small that majority is for the Conservatives. So, yes, OK, let's say the Liberal Democrats do win this seat, the majority is, okay, it's only reduced by one, but it does bring into play, doesn't it, how fragile that majority is?
Well, absolutely, and given that Theresa May is running a few scrapes on certain policy areas, like grammar schools, and suddenly the rebels there are threatening to scupper it unless it gets watered down drastically. You know, the majority of about 12 or 16, depending on how you count it, you know, starts to look very thin indeed if they lose one to the Lib Dems. And obviously, she'll have this, you know, public embarrassment over a Brexit by-election. So given that this is the singular thing that's the heart of her agenda, you know, it doesn't look very good in the sense of voters, you know, in what's meant to be a very safe Tory seat now, you know, so publicly rejected.
Let's look at some of the numbers. There's a couple of sort of pieces of data that I want to talk through before I go to some analysis Leo's looked at. One's around Theresa May's polling, and I think that the message I think I'm taking from our early conversation is that, you know, the inbox is building up, as I call it. You know, there's lots of difficulties for her. But actually, if you look at some of the numbers, it's still worth remembering how strong a position she is in. So YouGov's most recent poll, which, you know, isn't that different to what it's always been showing, has Theresa May seen as the best prime minister by 51%, Corbyn on 18, Don't Know on 31. So somebody unkind would say Labour should elect Don't Know as leader. But on the other hand, actually, you know, to give Corbyn his due, perhaps there is space for that 18 to grow. And on a serious note, if there are 49 that don't say Theresa May, then presumably that's who he'll try to convince that, you know, should back him, and a lot of those are Labour supporters.
Mm.
But there's other numbers that I think are important too. So when you ask people what are the big issues facing the country, unsurprisingly, Britain leaving the EU is the main one. On 61% say that. 47% say asylum and immigration, perhaps not surprising with the migrant crisis and the recent discussion around the destruction of the jungle in Calais, which we haven't talked about yet. And the Conservatives are overwhelmingly trusted over Labour on these important issues. So whereas, you know, Labour poll better on things like the NHS and housing, which are seen as less relevant. And actually a lesser discussed poll finding, which is actually quite important, is on this issue about whether Parliament or the Prime Minister should have the final say on Article 50, and when that's evoked, 54% say the Prime Minister, 30% say Parliament, and they're typically Remainers, will say that. And then finally, there's no obvious surge at the moment in support for Scottish independence. So I guess when you take all of that together, it's not static, it's not fixed. Actually, we should remember with all of this that the Prime Minister's position is still, as we sit here, relatively strong. If we add to that the state of the parties, Britain Elects, which is a great Twitter account, which I'm sure a lot of people follow that listen to the show or watch the show. But if they don't, they should. That's Britain Elects. They have a sort of rolling average of the VI polls, voting intention polls, which give the Conservatives a 12-point lead over Labour and a thumping majority in the House of Commons, I guess, which brings together all of what we've been saying, which is the Conservatives still look in a pretty strong position, and I guess that's why some Conservatives want an early election. So, Leo, I'll bring you in here. So one of the things that I've noticed, which is a common discussion point in academic circles, in polling circles, is this idea of, OK, let's accept it, the next general election. If we accept the next general election is going to be really bad for Labour, what's Labour's flaw? I kind of have this granted qualitative hunch, rather than based on data, that I don't see how Labour goes below 26 or 28. I think that's kind of where they'd end up. But you've been looking at some analysis on this idea of Labour's floor, where you think it might be, what past data shows us. So what have you found?
Right, so I've looked at it in two ways. So firstly, I have looked at all the post-war elections and the polls at the equivalent point in the Parliament. So we're 18 months since last election, and I've compared the relative standing of the parties in each previous Parliament, 18 months in, with the general election that follows that. And as you'd expect, there's some relationship. So if a party 18 months in is doing extremely well, then it goes on to win the general election more often than not. If it's doing extremely badly, it goes on to lose the election more often than not. The correlation is okay. It explains about half the difference. But what I found interesting and what surprised me when I looked at that this week was this. Regardless of who is leading, regardless of whether it's the government leading or the opposition leading, between this point and the coming election, the gap between the parties generally halves. So it's not that there's a swing to the government or a swing to the opposition, it's that whoever is leading, that lead halves. So typically, I think we tend to think oppositions are usually ahead at this point. So we tend to sort of think, you know, not say, let's think in sort of 93, 94, when Labour were, 15 points up, that lead then sort of halved by the time you got to the election. But the interesting consequence of that, the implication of this, is it also happens the other way around. So when a government is miles ahead 18 months in, then come the next election, that lead is often a lot smaller. As I say, this is a fairly crude model. This isn't a perfect prediction. But it suggests if Labour, as you just said, are 12 points down, that would mean that actually we're on course for the Tories only to win the election by 6 points, which I've got to say surprised me. Mm. It's sort of not the kind of typical expectation of midterm blues and swings towards the government. But it was what came out of the
model. Is there an example of an election where the government were very far ahead, putting you on the spot here, where the government were very far ahead, but it shrunk? I'm guessing that maybe 2005.
So I think before the 2001 election, before the 2005 election, are both cases where that happened. So around 98-99, it looks to me like the government was something like 27 points up and ended up winning the election by about 10 points. So it does happen.
And there are similarities there, aren't there? Because you've got, Tony Blair, immortal. At the time, 2001, less so 2005, of course, but around that time, looking very strong, the lead shrinks, and to be honest, his opponents weren't necessarily seen as great either. So there's good news for Corbyn there.
There's something to be said for that, and as I say, look, this surprised me. I looked at it in another way as well. So I looked at European parties, the sister parties, as you were to the Labour Party. And I picked a bunch of parties that in the late 90s, early noughties, all had parliamentary election scores of above 35% or ideally above 40%, of which Labour was one of them. So parties that you would think were extremely dominant. And all of those parties now are scoring below 30 points, and almost all of them are scoring below 25 points or have scored below 25 points. Most of them have anyway. Labour actually, out of those parties, has so far had the smallest fall, so it's not hit the same lows as the other parties have. Mm. Now, look, every country has their differences, most of all different electoral systems, and I'm not using this to say that what happens in one country is inevitably going to happen in another. But I think this does show to me that if you look at the party of the centre-left, you think, look, this is a major party. It's scoring in the high 35s, 40%. There's no way it can score below 25%. It's got this solid base of support. They're not going to desert it. I think, you've got to look at these and say, well, actually, it's happened in other places. Why shouldn't it happen to Labour? I think what we can take is just we should be less confident in our assertion that Labour couldn't go below 25, because it's happened in other places.
I suppose there is this other argument, slightly related, which is around the sort of PASOKification of the Labour Party that Corbyn prevented, which is that by having a left-wing takeover of the Labour Party, it avoided there being some kind of, I don't know where it would have manifested itself necessarily, but a momentum-style organisation being a completely new party.
And I left out PASOK here because, this obviously Greece is a country that has extremely different electoral system and current economic state and so on. So I think that's a different story. And, there's something to be said for that. And look, it's clearly harder for an insurgent party to appear in the UK in the way that it is in a proportional system.
So I'll bring Asa back in a minute. But what side of the coin? So you seem to have presented almost two separate pieces of analysis that could go either way. One is that says actually Labour does a lot better at the next general election than maybe people currently think. And I would personally share that view, as I sort of said at the beginning. Mainly because I don't buy. There's lots of people on, academics and pollsters that say, "Oh, well, Labour might end up on 20 points or below 25." And I just have this hunch, and I could be completely wrong, egg on my face, that at the end of the day, there are still quite a lot of people that want a left-wing alternative to the Conservatives. And a Labour moderate, such as myself, or before I left the party, would say it's not good enough to be on 26, 28 anyway. You want to be on 35 plus, and therefore, there's no glory in being in the upper 20s, but I just have a hunch that's where they end up. Whereas the other piece of analysis you've shown, which is that if you look at European examples, actually there's no God-given right to be there. It could plummet further. Do you have a hunch on which way?
Well, look, I've probably got a gut feeling and a head feeling that I've just shown you the numbers that make me think that actually Labour should be rebounding. And there's another data point that I haven't included here, which is we are in the honeymoon period of a new Prime Minister. Mm. Historically, that is a better time for a party in their polls when they're in their first 6 to 9 months of a new leader. So that's another reason you might expect the polls to narrow a bit. But honestly, my gut tells me that when the question is put of who you want to be the next Prime Minister, and the public really consider Corbyn against Theresa May, then Labour's vote is going to be squeezed far more than it has been so far. Mm. I'm not giving you a real answer here because I've still got two contradictory views, and it's difficult to reconcile, and that's as good as you're going to get.
Oh, very harsh mistress there, Leo. Let's talk about, bring Acer back in. Let's talk about UKIP, because I mean, until this week, it felt like they were the story, weren't they? And there's their leadership contest that's going on. They've achieved everything they ever wanted in the Brexit vote, but then they seem to have lurched from one crisis to the next since. What's your assessment of where they are?
Well, yes, it's certainly the problem of working out what comes next, in that they've spent decades raging against the establishment, clamouring for the UK to have its eye, and then, you know, the UKIP now needs to work out what the P is for afterwards. It's sort of, you know, Brexit, you know, and then what sort of thing. We know it's going to happen. They have to sort of... They have to rage against society. There'll be a betrayal at some point. And so they have to find out who's there to keep them relevant to the debate in the meantime. Because Theresa May owns Brexit right now. If you want to vote for Brexit, you vote for Theresa May. And so UKIP, then, what does it stand for? And so this is why with the contest it's fascinating. Because there was the first attempt to do it. You know, Diane James came through. And there was a kind of, you know, B-grade list of UKIP talent that came out. And it kind of showed. And that Diane only lasted 18 days. Mm. And so now we have actually the serious, you know, sort of bigger players coming into the picture. Of course, Stephen Wolfe is now the UKIP leader that never was. So he's out of the ranks. But, you know, Paul Nuttall, obviously, it's justified why he's leading right now, because he's got the name recognition. He's respected by all sides. Unlike Suzanne Evans below him, he hasn't really picked a fight publicly with the Faragistas, for example, so it's not easy to lump him in with a faction. He's not sort of... He's not going to revive old hostilities. Whereas that might not be said the same for Raheem Kassam, who's in the third, who's a very combative...
I should say, hold that thought, that for the benefit of people listening, so we've got the odds for the next permanent UKIP leader as we are here now, or as of this afternoon, which have Paul Nuttall at 4-11, real nailed-on favourite, Suzanne Evans 4-1, Raheem Kassam, I nearly said Sterling, Raheem Kassam 5-1, sorry, and then there's a couple of others there that may or may not still be involved, but they're the big three that you're talking about.
Well, that's the thing, because actually if I can mention on sort of the cited people sort of there on the lower ranks, Bill Etheridge, obviously he's recently already thrown his weight around Paul Nuttall, over behind Paul Nuttall even, and backed him, and I personally wouldn't be surprised if other people like Peter Whittle, who's cited there, then do also recognise you know, that they're not going to get much traction in this race and then sort of, you know, pull out and back him. I mean, that might well be on the cards. We, you know, have to see, because certainly Nuttall is getting some quite heavyweight endorsements, you know, Lord Pearson and all these sort of UKIP dignitaries, and he's kind of sewing it up very fast at this rate. And so as a result, back to Kassam, if I might. Certainly he's causing a lot of stir on Twitter. And it seems to be there was a poll by Matthew Goodwin of UKIP councillors that found that Nuttall was very far ahead, and obviously Kassam's tried to claim that the election's already rigged in a very sort of Trumpist fashion, in a sense. And so I suspect, you know, we shouldn't get sucked into the whole Twitter noise about him, in a sense. I mean, he'll be there. I mean, certainly he is interesting. He could be, if he was elected, the first, you know, Asian party leader. He'd be 30 years old. He'd be the youngest party leader, as he told a recent newspaper in an interview. But I would question who actually would vote for him, in a sense, except for the sort of neo-Farageites, in a sense, of the party.
I can never work out whether this make UKIP great again is... not sarcastic, but maybe a bit ironic.
I think he believes it, that's the thing. It's sort of, he's serious and good on the branding. Aaron Banks backs him as a result. And
Donald Trump's not exactly sort of case study of popularity in the UK at the moment.
No, but the thing is, Kassam practices a sort of American Breitbart-style politics, in a sense. Obviously, Trump and Breitbart are very close, and in the same sense, you know, he is almost a shock jock to UK politics now. And obviously, he's managed to, he was responsible. He's said to be linked for Nigel Farage going to America to talk to the Conservatives there. He sort of woos him with this US-style politics. It's very controversial for some. Suzanne Evans said it was characterised as kind of far-right, in a sense, and that obviously raised hackles among the Kassamites. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I would then question, if we are accepting that UKIP has to not fall apart at the end of this, you know, if he let's say he got elected, you know, that again, he's part of his policy program is to basically drive Douglas Carswell out of the party, to make him apologise and hand over all his money to the HQ in order to stay in, basically. So, you know, his form of unity will be more war. And so that's why, for example, Nuttall is at least the one who's the most unstained by all the civil war.
So I suppose for UKIP to go on, Paul Nuttall wins with Aaron Banks's...
Yes, because he at least is someone who can keep it together and not have it all fall apart in sort of more, you know, wars of personalities, in a sense. I mean, Suzanne, certainly, she is respected by people. She obviously has the rare achievement of being UKIP leader for 3 days, after Nigel Farage stepped down for a bit. But then she's stuck ahead above the parapet, controversially, of course, and called Nigel Farage, you know, he's perceived as divisive, in a sense. And the Farageites won't forgive her for this.
Mm. I mean, Leo, the sort of discussion topic here really is about UKIP's future, where UKIP goes from here. Is UKIP finished? I was looking at some polling YouGov did, and they've done it very successfully before with other party memberships. They've done some polling of UKIP party members, and UKIP party members seem pretty pleased with themselves, which is perhaps not surprising if you consider events of the last 6 months. But there was one finding in particular that stood out, a couple actually. One was that when asked whether UKIP should go towards the centre, stay as they are, or go further right, clear majority think they should stay kind of where they are, probably reasonably happy with Brexit, achieving Brexit, if you like. And they also said they should target Labour voters rather than Conservative voters, which I thought was almost counterintuitive for a party membership that recognises that it's centre-right, kind of likes its position, wants to stay there, but equally wants to sort of target Labour voters. How do you see UKIP's future? Because there is this view that they've kind of done what they needed to do now. May owns Brexit, as Ace has alluded to. That's kind of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think asking even party members who, you know, would be relatively better engaged with politics on questions of left, right, without talking specific policies, I think is not entirely helpful, other than telling us something about sort of broad perspectives of what those labels mean. Mm. I mean, the interesting thing about polling of UKIP supporters, so obviously not about members, is that they often take quite left-wing economic views. So, you know, UKIP supporters tend to like bashing banks and putting up taxes on the rich, and such things that if Ed Miliband was to suggest would get called communist. And I think particularly with this point that I think you've both mentioned of Theresa May essentially owning Brexit, the space for a authoritarian party of the economic right is clearly limited. But there is no authoritarian or closed or less liberal or whatever we want to call it, perhaps not such a loaded term as authoritarian, of the economic left. That's a space that's open. And if I were thinking where UKIP could strategically flourish, it seems to me that it's the space that didn't exist when Tony Blair was in charge of Labour, because he was close enough to it, but a space that is a bit like Corbyn on economics, perhaps, but far less liberal, much less interested in, or much less supportive of immigration, much less supportive of diversity and gay rights and stuff like that, and essentially tickled the fancy of a lot of people who are put off Labour.
Mm. My hunch is still that there's going to be at least 10% of the vote there for UKIP if they can get their act together. Let's move on to let's take a different angle with the final few moments. There's been some polling that Political Betting have done, or Mike's done with YouGov, which looks at this hypothetical idea of if there was a stop Brexit party, how would your voting intention change or otherwise? Now, I should stress, this was only done in England and Wales. Must admit, I'm not 100% sure why, but that's where it was done. 4,500 sample size. And the results are as follows. Conservatives are on 34. Stop Brexit ends up just shy of 26%, so 25.9 if that precision is necessary. Labour ends up around 19, UKIP 15-ish. Other, you know, 6 or 7. So ultimately, Stop Brexit Party ends up second place, around 26% of the vote. I guess there's a couple of different ways to interpret these numbers, and I'll get both of your thoughts here. One is that, wow, that's quite impressive, because they're the official opposition, and this really sort of changes the dynamics of political realignment, changes the dynamics of what happens in the future in Britain. Another interpretation, which is more mine if I'm honest, as you can probably tell, is that even if there is this big realignment, even if this can be delivered mechanically in an election, the Tories still win it, and therefore Brexit doesn't happen. I guess, Leo, I'll come back to you. What's your interpretation of this? And also, not just in terms of the substance of the issue, but also the polling itself, and how useful that is.
Yeah, I think on the polling itself, I'm always very sceptical about asking people voting attention in some hypothetical future situation. You know, I mean, the question here asks about formed by members of the Conservative, Labour and Lib Dem parties. Well, actually a party that was led by, I don't know, someone who looked and sounded like Nick Clegg but wasn't tainted in the way he was, and had people with the politics of Gordon Brown and George Osborne in. in, say, I suspect would do a lot better than 26% if it could break through. So I think the hypothetical here is getting in the way of the reality. But I think it's still useful, because what it tells us is there's about a quarter of the public who are diehard Remainers and would put a single issue party over a multiple issue party. And it might only be 26%. That might be the cap of people who care about Brexit and care about overturning Brexit more than anything else, and will pick that above everything, which, I mean, that's a pretty significant chunk of the population, but it's not going to form a majority.
Not going to form a majority, and I think that number, though, does roughly chime with some polling I've seen where the question gets asked, essentially, do you accept the referendum result? Should there be a second referendum in the future? And what you typically find, I believe, is that about half of the Remain vote says, I accept the result, basically, that there shouldn't be another referendum. It doesn't totally chime with that figure, but roughly it does, doesn't it? It's about, you know, if we say the Remain vote was 48%, half of that's 24, this is 25, this is 26. There is, you know, it kind of does tally. And I suppose, I guess the question is, if such a party did exist, would that half that currently accept the result maybe eventually not, if Brexit doesn't go very well? I'll bring you back in, Asa. There are all these rumours, particularly around the Labour Party, or have been in the past, about donors not being happy with Corbyn and wanting to fund something else. And I've always been very sceptical about it. But I suppose this sort of number might give them encouragement, at least, if not make them do it, but
yes,
it might give them encouragement.
At the same time with Tony Blair trying to wonder how he can get back involved in politics, I almost have a sort of mini fantasy right now of, you know, Tony Blair leading a new Labour, in a sense, with
New Labour Squared.
Renegades all joining en masse, in a sense. And obviously, like, you know, Anna Soubry, for a good measure, just chucked in there, why not, from the Tories. But the thing is, the mechanics of that would be far too messy, in my opinion, right now. It's sort of, at least for a sort of unashamedly pro-EU party. But certainly it does show that there is a huge well of opinion of Europhile, so dare I say, metropolitan liberal sort of style opinion, you know, that people can appeal to. Mm. And so as a result, it's a challenge for the other parties to try and appeal to this. The closest we have there is the Liberal Democrats, of course. Tim Farron, the closest we have to unabashed, you know, Europhile, second referendum, stop Brexit and by any other means. And so, given how we've been talking earlier about Richmond Park and whether the Brexit by-election means, you know, that there could be a bit of a shock, I mean, it certainly shows that the people are there. Because obviously, with Richmond Park, more people voted for Remain there than live in Witney. Which obviously, given that in Witney that was, you know, the surprise result, that, you know, a bit bigger swing for the Liberal Democrats in Richmond Park, where they represented from 1997 till 2010, let's remember, you know, could tip them over the edge into victory there. So it's definitely instructive and interesting for Europhiles around Britain. Then
I suppose this sort of polling also brings up wider discussions beyond this around realignments, sort of electoral pacts, things like that, doesn't it? And I know, Leah, this has been something that a lot of people on the left talk about, don't they? This idea of progressive alliances. Labour shouldn't stand here, Lib Dem shouldn't stand there. I mean, this poll in particular doesn't necessarily add weight to that, but what's your sort of interpretation of some of those discussions? Because there were some Labour MPs who were quite close to the Labour leadership.
Yeah, I mean, not
saying Labour shouldn't stand in Richmond.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not, they weren't nobodies. They were
Lisa
Nandy
was one, wasn't she?
Significant MPs. Yeah, wasn't it Clive Lewis?
Clive Lewis was one. Yeah, Jonathan Reynolds, the Shadow Minister.
Yeah, it was a Labour list article.
You know, these are serious people, but it was shot down within hours, if that. And I think that's the point, that, you know, Asa, sort of, your hypothetical ran up against the rocks of the mechanics and the difficulty of it. And I think, you know, this is why I sort of find it slightly difficult to take seriously a poll question like this, that this might be true in a world where those parties were available, but, you know, you have the infrastructure of the parties and it's very hard to overturn. You know, you can't just wish them away and wish this new infrastructure in existence in 650-odd constituencies. And, you know, one of the reasons, I'm sure, why Labour is definitely going to be fielding a candidate is you've got a local party there that's going to be absolutely apoplectic if they don't get to field a candidate and they have to sit on their hands when there's a by-election on and they don't get to fight the Lib Dems.
CLP chair to sit this one out for the Lib Dems until back in May 2015 with a big traitor.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, why would they do that? And Labour's leadership is not particularly passionately wanting to overturn Brexit, so, you know, they're not going to be the party that's doing this. The Lib Dems, well, OK. I mean, the Lib Dems seem to me to be the only route in which you can have a serious stop Brexit party that could command 26% of the vote. I mean, and Richmond could be the springboard. They don't at the moment look like they've got the leadership that is capable of doing that, but they do have a fair wind behind them, at least.
But I suppose, Asa, if the Labour and Liberal Democrat vote, so let's say Zach Goldsmith retains,
yes,
but the Labour and Lib Dem vote equates to more votes than he got, that sort of argument's not going to go away, is it? There'll still be people saying, if only Labour hadn't stood.
But then obviously, if we accept the sort of stop Brexit scenario here, the problem is that you could also do a contrary interpretation and look at the UKIP vote, and add that to the Conservative vote, and say, well, that's the Brexit majority there for you, you know. So, this can be spun many different ways, but certainly, I would say the problem is, you know, with the Labour and Lib Dems, yes, they've kind of split the anti-Goldsmith vote here, in a sense. So, you know, I bet Tim Frank won't be very pleased with this, and obviously with the Labour and Lib Dems anyway, obviously they're meant to be rivals in part, and you know, fighting, and so this is in keeping with tradition, because obviously you know, there has been obviously a search since UKIP came onto the scene for the left-wing UKIP, the contrary, the bizarro UKIP for the Europhiles. And the problem is that you're not going to find the narrative of, you know, Labour MPs defecting to the Lib Dems in such numbers that we saw for the Tories and UKIP, because, you know, when you speak to them, they just sort of think that, well, they're a part of a bigger party, and then they just start sort of shrugging and say, well, just it's Tim Farron. That's the problem, you know.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week, but thanks for a very interesting discussion. A lot of topics that I know we're going to come back to in the coming weeks. That's all we've got time for this week's PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. Stay tuned. Next week we'll be revisiting events in Washington as we head to the final straights of the race for the White House.